the Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams, and today on the show, it's Nick Galusis. Very excited to have him on. He talks about teaching, of which he has a storied career. He talks about composers and working in institutions and bureaucracies and all that stuff. And it's you know, the show has an unusually positive tone to it with him on. It's great. He's got a great outlook. I know some of you kind of come down on the show sometimes. I don't know, some of you. Once in a while, many years ago, there were people saying it gets a little negative. Well, you know, that's the way it goes, you know. 99% of us aren't doing that well. you know, or we have to deal with kids, you know, throwing boogers at our guitars and stuff like that. And then there's about 20 of you that are in La La Land there. That's great. There's nothing against it. It's great. But anyway, this is a guy who's really enjoying what he's doing, and he has an infectious sort of positive outlook that, you know, I went away feeling really good about the guitar. And that's great. That's great for us all. So get ready for a very realistic, but also a positive outlook on like the direction that we're going in. And it's, you know, I don't know. He got me excited. I hope you get excited too. The show is sponsored by Savage Classical. That's SAVAGE classical.com. That's Richard Sage is over there. He'll give you the guitar of your dreams if you tell him that Brett sent you. All right? That's savageclassical.com. You know, and I want to put more of these out, but I think there's no reason why you guys shouldn't be calling in. And we had, you know, we had this happen a whole bunch of times over the last couple of years. People call in, or they reach out to me, Brett, B-R-E-T, at brettwilliamsmusic.com. You can just support the show at brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Or you can promote your stuff. It's silly for you not to do this. It makes no sense. It's like, it's depending on what you want me to do, it's cheaper than anything else. You know, certainly cheaper than taking out ads in the magazines or whatever. So, you know, with the same reach. And there's no reason why you can't call. And we set up, you put something in the intro, you know, Rupert did it, Fred did it, a bunch of people have done it. Michael and Joanna, Castellani, Andreaccio duo did it. You do it. You got a new project or something? Let's do it. I don't know if I'm really prepared to talk to people who are releasing their first album. When I only talk to like 6 people a year, but you know, maybe, but really there's no reason why you can't just support the show. It's a cheap, easy way. And we get to talk to each other, get to know each other. And you know, if it takes off, hey, you know, let's make a whole episode out of the damn thing. Everything's going good with the baby though. A couple of, you know, sent some, you know, money and said, hey, go out to dinner on me, or you know, here's something for a beer. I really appreciate that. That's really nice of you. You know, or here's a little something for Wally. Wally's the name of the kid. I don't know. My mom hates that name. I asked her, I said, well, what was it like when you named your kid Brett and you had to tell the, you know, grandma and grandpa that? You think they liked my brother's name are Tyler and Rory. Do you think that my poor grandpa, you know, who fought for Christ and country in World War II, gets home and he's got his California daughter naming her kids after, like, I don't even know what this stuff means. Brett, Tyler, and Rory. Rory Williams. Can you imagine how that went? And she's got the nerve to give me shit about Wally. I'm just joking. She's sweet. She actually tried to reach out. She said that she just remembered that my grandma's name was Wally. So I don't know what her real name was. This must have been on the dad's side. We heard all about the Truitts, which were on grandma's side, but we didn't hear anything about the dad's side, which is usual. You know, I don't know. The boys sort of lose track of that kind of thing. man, I loved my grandpa though. I did like that guy. I don't know if love's a strong word. I mean, I loved him. But as I got older, I really appreciated his humor and stuff like that. Chuck Hamilton, great guy. Really good guy. He could talk about furniture. He could talk about sports. He could talk about music. He's a smart, smart dude. Anyway, yeah, no, I had a dream last night that I was cheating on Liz. This is terrible. But you know how you have these dreams? I would never do this with, what's her name? Oh God, what's her name? Jennifer Lawrence, of all people. I don't have a thing for Jennifer Lawrence. Anyway, my grandpa, I think that's why I'm thinking about it. Well, also, apparently his mother's name was Wally. But anyway, so he and my dad tried to talk me out of running off with Jennifer Lawrence. They said, you know, you have a child on the way and you're married now. You can't do that kind of thing. I said, well, why don't you guys wait a second? Let me tell you who it is. And they would have nothing to do with it. They didn't care who it was. I was like, it's actually a celebrity. And it's kind of like, she's everybody's celebrity. She's like she's one of the good ones. Everybody likes Jennifer Lawrence, you know? you know, if I am going to destroy my marriage, it's going to be with a celebrity who is, you know, who nobody, you know, really dislikes. Anyway, I think we're getting a little off topic. Anyway, yeah, so the kid's name's Wally. He passed all his little tests that he didn't agree to take. I don't know if you've had a kid in the last 15 years, but basically they test them for everything to scare the shit out of you every 4 days. You are just in a constant state of terror that your kid is going to come out with half a nose and four arms, and he's going to, you know, just be teased all his life, and I don't know. And this is no offense to a lot. I know a lot of you out there have forearm children. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I'm definitely going to tell Wally to support the forearm children out there and stick up for them. Because that's what we do in the Williams family. Even though that's not really sticking up for the week, is it? Forearms is, I mean, the guy's probably going to be okay. Anyway, we should get on with the show. This is it. This is Nick Galusis, a storied pedagogue. He was Matthew Cochran's teacher too, which kind of made me think like, oh, I'm going to talk to him. And I think, you know, the only thing I know I've had a lot of guys on, you know, it's been a guy. I don't know. Yeah. So I've been reaching out to people and, you know, we're going to line it up, but I'm kind of on this kick right now where I'm going to do Nick Galusis. I might try to get Paul Odette after that because they're both up there at Eastman. So, he suggested that I talk to Paul Odette. That would be great. So just be patient. I'm trying to, I don't know. I'm trying to do this, but I know that there's just been a lot of men on. I'm aware. You know, I reached out to a couple of people and they didn't get back to me. So that's what's going on. If you got any ideas, let me know. I've got plenty. I'm going to keep on working at it, at being more diverse in, and I mean, this isn't a joke. I mean, I'm going to try to do it. I know there's been dude after dude. Anyway, let's get on with the show. Let's have a couple of dudes. It's a great dude. This is Nick Galusis. You are an extremely accomplished guitarist, pedagogue. You've transcribed a lot of Bach's works. You have worked with living and non-living composers, and you have delved bravely into the world of the serial and atonal. Is that fair to say? I mean, you've done your work.
On my best days, yes, I think so. It's a pleasure to be here too with you, Brett. I appreciate your bringing me in.
Absolutely. Well, I had Matthew Cochran on last week, and I think he studied with you, right? Am I right? I mean, I know he was up there, and yep. I think you're the guy up there, and you are in Rochester right now. You're at the Eastman School of Music.
Yeah, I've been here since 93.
Yeah, yeah. And you were also at Manhattan, where you got your doctorate, but you also were a teacher there for a while. But you've been there since 93, you said.
Yes, so I started teaching at Manhattan right after I got my DMA, mm-hmm. I started teaching there in 84, and it was there for about 10 years, and then I got this job, so I came up here, and I've been here since then.
And then people will know, as you warned me, there are people playing there. You are in your studio at Eastman, so there is going to be some piano students playing, and it can take everybody back to those moments of studying with their teacher and having to listen to everybody else.
Yeah, I sometimes wish that it, you know, the walls are pretty thick in this old building, but they're not thick enough sometimes.
Pianos are pianos. And I mean, yeah, that's sort of the trade-off, is you don't want to be in a dark recording studio, but that's the only way you'd be able to get rid of that sound, right?
Right. And I have to say, I think that having a vibrant building is a double-edged sword. It's wonderful because you walk out the door and there's just a million musicians with all the same hopes and dreams, and you want to help them. But then, you know, sometimes it's a nut house. We work in these kinds of buildings with these high vibrating humans, and it's a, you know, they keep you young and they make you old.
I mean, that's true. You've been working with college age kids for the last 30 years. So, you know, I mean, that's pretty outstanding. And as a teacher, you've won many awards. You have students that have won pretty much all the major guitar competitions in North America and also just sort of around the globe. So teaching seems to be, maybe the biggest part of your legacy. There aren't many that can sort of say that they've been doing what you've been doing over the last several decades.
Well, I appreciate that. And as it turns out, you know, I think that is the honor of my professional life. Yeah. I mean, I've played a few good concerts, I've made a few good records and all that, but
take that away from you. That's
no, true. No. But I want to say that as it turns out, as I look back at the risk of sounding a bit like Mr. Holland's opus here, I think the honor of my professional life is seeing what they've done, what I've managed to do for them. But then, you know, you see them years later and you still see the seeds that you planted, but they've grown. And that's something special. It's like parenthood, but in a highly professional way, and it's wonderful. You know, as it turns out, yeah, that is the honor of my professional life, and I don't think I'll ever lose that perspective now.
It really is, and it's something that you don't. I mean, I, at least I didn't think about it when I was younger, but now I do, and I do think about, like, you know, really what it comes down to is, and as an artist, is how many lives you touch, and as a teacher, and as a teaching artist, it's pretty profound, and I can't even imagine what it would be like to be, you know, at your point in your career and be able to look back at these people who are now, you know, in their 40s, you know. And be able to sort of look at their careers and know that you have inspired them so much.
And who's inspired me? I mean, a lot of my generation have built a pretty big United States and slightly further outside of the United States guitar machinery. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. You know, just a few generations ago, there was one. And then there was two, and then there were about six. Now we have extraordinary people in every state throughout the United States doing unbelievable work. And my colleagues, I love them, and they continue to inspire me. I don't mean to sound overly humble. I'm sincere.
We've got amazing
people in our world.
Yes, it's a much bigger world than it was for your generation, I would say. Your generation being my teacher was Adam Holzman, so he's about the same, you know, sort of. You guys have a lot in common, you know. You guys are both sort of you really focus on getting your guys ready for these competitions and ready to kind of, you know, start their career on the right track, or at least sort of have a general idea of the level that's out there. Is that really an important aspect? Because I never really talked to Adam about that when I interviewed him several, like 10 years ago, But I should have. And having you here now makes me want to do it. But what is sort of, what do you think these kids, and not even kids, but like, you know, adults are getting out of going to these competitions?
Well, competitions are an interesting thing. I mean, I think, you know, the word competition can include, I mean, competitions as competitions, but also getting a college teaching job. I have a huge doctoral program, and they come here for that degree because they want to be college professors. Their plan, and most of my students come here because they have a career in mind. It's a triple career that it involves performing and teaching and recording, and all three fit into each other. And so winning a college teaching job, and as we're seeing now, there are a bunch of them that are starting to open up, which is, you know, not unexpected. Those are competitions. And I think that to prepare for those competitions is, you know, you have to play well, you have to have something to say, you have to show at every masterclass that you give real improvement. When people go to these college teaching interviews and they have to give a masterclass, I tell my guys and gals, make sure that the search committee sees improvement. It could be one small thing. David Russell's really good at this when you see him teach. He'll pick one thing and he'll get you to do it, and everyone can hear it. And that's what improvement looks at, one brick at a time. So that's that kind of competition. But I know you're, Brett, you're also referring to competitions. GFA, Darwin, Mallorca, and a lot of the more regional ones that are flourishing around right now. I mean, I think that it's more, personally, I find it more important to get them to play to express rather than impress. I think that you just go show what you have. You know, to go and try to play for someone the way you think you want them to play, or that they're the wrong note cops, or they're counting mistakes, or, you know, I don't know. I don't think that that's how I teach the way I wanted to be taught, and I didn't want to be taught that way. So try to teach them to be expressive and to have something to say and to try to move people, and also to be physical, because, you know, we're nice. We're lucky. We have nice guitars, but this is our instrument, and we have to build our instrument like the singer next door. They have to build their instrument too. So they have to show that they've built their instrument. They have to show that they have control. They have to show that they have something to say and some humanity. And, you know, if you've had your heart broken a couple of times, that'll come out. If you've, you know, if you've had some highs, that'll come out. So I think it's just about preparing people to show what they have.
That's so important what you said, because I think that when we think about competitions, I wasn't a big competer. I like to say, when I was younger, I would have said, oh, I just didn't want to do it. But really, it was sort of a monetary issue. You know, I just didn't have I wasn't coming from that sort of, I wasn't able to fly around and do competitions when I was a college kid. But I think that idea, knowing now, having met people that have judged it, having judged some things myself, it's just like knowing that we aren't looking for people to play, like you're saying, the wrong note police. That's not really what gets you into first or second or third. What really does is being able to, sure, you have that stuff, but the expressiveness is what you really see in like the top tier competitive players. There is a level of expressiveness that maybe fourth or fifth place didn't necessarily possess. So that is, it does help you kind of crystallize your ideas and get ready to show them to people. So that's an excellent point, that it's not just about technique, it's about expressiveness.
I mean, technique is,
that's what judges are looking for.
And technique is doing what the music requires. No more and no less.
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, I do think that they follow, one follows the other. But but what you just said is exactly, I think, the way people need to approach competitions. And I think that if you have something to say, you have something to say. And that's what draws us in. We not only want to be astonished, but we want to be moved. At least I think most of us do. And I heard a line that I think it was Pepe Romero who said, I think it was Pepe who said, some people go to concerts because they want to hear beautiful music, beautiful sound, beautiful playing. Yeah. Some people want to go to concerts because they want to hear, you know, a few mistakes. They feel better about themselves. I try to give a little something to everybody.
Yeah. Right. Right. Well, that is true. That is sort of the curse of being a guitarist going to a concert, is that you are constantly, at least, you know, especially as a younger guitarist, you're moving between, you know, sort of feeling bad about yourself and feeling really, I feel good about myself. That's right. As far as sort of being a teacher at Eastman, what do you think has sort of set Eastman apart over the years, faculty-wise, guitar department-wise? Can you give us a little rundown of the history of the guitar at that institution?
Yes, of course. I'm happy to. You know, I had no intention of coming here. There was never a guitar department or guitar at all at Eastman before 1993. And I was really happy at Manhattan. We were having a wonderful time. It was a real juggernaut. We had just brought Segovia up there for his last master classes. And, my colleagues were Barbosa Lima, Sharon Isbin, and Manuel Barrego. And the four of us, you know, had an unbelievable time with Segovia at the end of Segovia's life. And I felt like we were really doing something. I had no intention of leaving. But I had always heard about Eastman, and it was this giant, legendary place up north. And so they decided they were going to open up a guitar program. Right around the same time Juilliard in Indiana opened up programs, Eastman decided they were going to do it too. And I think it was because, sincerely, the repertoire made it, the repertoire required that they open up a guitar program. It wasn't because of a guitar personality or because of any other reason, but everyone had started writing for the guitar who was anybody. And along with a number of the composition faculty up here, Christopher Rouse, Joe Schwantner, Sam Adler, Augusta Reed Thomas, they all wrote for the guitars. Sidney Hodgkinson, it's a long list of great composers up here who had been writing. Some of them were writing for me, some were writing. Sam Adler wrote his sonata for Steve Robinson. Joseph Schwantner wrote his concerto for Sharon Isbin. I mean, there was already a guitar vibe up here, but there wasn't any guitar. Paul Odette was here. Paul's been here since 76.
Wow.
World's greatest lute player.
Yeah. Lovely,
unbelievable colleague. Anyway, so they decided to open up a guitar program. And a number of us, you know, were approached about throwing our hat in the ring. I was one of them. So I did. And got called to come up. And I knew that there were some really great colleagues of mine who were also being brought up. And I had no idea what was going to happen. But I came up anyway because I wanted to see the place and meet the people. And so I had, I played a concert, gave class, had a few interviews, and was offered the job. And I didn't know if I had another guitar life outside of Manhattan in me. I had really thrown myself into that program, and it was a pleasure to work there. But I had two small kids, and I thought maybe moving up to Rochester would be a good thing. Yeah. I wanted to work with Paul. The library is the largest library in the Western Hemisphere, and that was a big attraction.
I didn't know that. The largest music library in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah. It's an unbelievable library. and I love the colleagues, and I just love the place. It's an incredible place.
Go ahead. No, and what did you work on with Paul Odette?
Well, I mean, a lot of my students.
Did you play lute, or did you?
No. But I loved early music, as mentioned. So
absolutely.
Whenever I have something to play that's early music, I go down the hall and play it for Paul, and he's played some of his things for me when he's getting ready to record them. A lot of my students. I mean, I'm the only guitar teacher here, but a lot of my students, I send over to work with Paul. Sometimes he sends his lute students, who are also, you know,
guitarists. Yeah,
closet form guitarists.
Yeah,
to work with me. And our studios are always interacting, which is really, really a pleasure. Paul gives master classes for my students, and he gives master classes for guitarists around the country. He goes out to USC every year, and so he's a perfectly wonderful colleague. And I've learned so much from him, and he's, you know, such a beautiful person and player. But also the guitar, I wanted it to be part of the string department. I thought that was important. And I don't like guitar ghettos. I really didn't think that was something that I wanted to see here. I wanted guitar to be integrated into the string department. String, harp, guitar, and lute are all part of one large department. Because I think that we have to rise to that. level. Mm-hmm. So eventually I became chair of that department and was for about 10 years. And I learned a lot. I learned more than I want to know about the string world. But they're amazing. I mean, they are amazing at what they do. And now that I'm no longer chair, because enough's enough, I want to focus on my students. I bring a lot of what I learned from being closely associated with my colleagues. I also thought the guitar should be part of, you know, the school, the fabric of the school by doing chamber music. So I work a lot with the flute professor here, Bonita Boyd. We've recorded and played a lot.
Yes.
A lot of the string players and I play together, but also I've worked with the composers. And I think now that the student composers are working with my students, Eastman guitarists play Eastman composers is a big concert that we always put on.
Yeah.
It's a pretty active place, and it's been a pleasure. I never knew I'd be here for this long, but I'm still here.
I mean, it seems in your idea of integrating it. I talked about it last week with Matthew Cochran, the importance that we both had as Holzman students, him with Bruce, me and Adam,
yep,
about how important it was for us to connect ourselves with the world of classical music in a way that maybe some other studios didn't think of it. And you're right. Guitar Ghetto is the perfect world. Not the perfect world, the opposite of that. But yep, it is kind of what you see in some of these programs. And we're just sort of robbing ourselves of all of these resources, because at no point, unless you are in your position, at no point are you going to have access to those musicians like this ever again. It never happens again. And I think having the idea of you having the composers, you talk a lot about composition. You talk about that as a driving force behind what got Eastman to adopt the guitar into their program and eventually into their string program, which is a whole new sort of seat of honor, you know, in my opinion, and I think in most people's opinions. It's the repertoire, stupid.
Yes.
Right? That's the big thing that we're always up against. And you already talked about one thing you're actively doing. You have this festival every year where do all your students have to play a little something or work directly with the composers?
No, it's some people, I have to get them there.
Yeah, and some people don't want to do it.
What? Yeah. They don't. I mean, yeah. some of them just take to it like ducks take to water, but some don't. And one way that I've found that helps a lot is like when they take the guitar history and lit class, one of the things they have to do is they have to do transcriptions, whether it's music from tablature or from other sources. It's an important thing, but making a transcription is what we do when a composer who doesn't play the guitar gives us a piece, right? How many pieces have you gotten by composers? And you have to make a transcription of it. There's no way it works. It doesn't even have the soul of the guitar in it. It could be written for the marimba, what they write. Part of it is as we arrange it, and Bream did this, Segovia did this, everybody that we know who plays music written for the guitar needs to be transcribed. So yeah, that is a bridge to get them from making transcriptions of Weiss or Scarlatti into making arrangements of pieces newly written for the guitar that sound and work well. It's a second birth.
And not only that with your students, but did you have to do that with Schwattner? Did you have to sort of work on those pieces? I mean, actually, he's a guitarist, right?
Exactly. I was smiling because I was going to say.
So now that I think he was on top of it.
From Afar, that piece that he wrote first, mm-hmm, for orchestra, and then he made a version for solo guitar.
Right.
From Afar doesn't mean distance, it means time. So it meant that he was hearkening back to his youth when he was playing Carcassi studies and Source studies and way back far in his past. Mm. So I love his music, and I think he's a great composer, and he's promised to write me another piece, but haven't seen it yet. He was here at Eastman for a long time, went to Yale for about 10 years, and now he's living somewhere in southern Vermont composing music. And I heard the other day on Martin Luther King Day his piece called New Morning for the World. And this is an unbelievable piece. If you haven't heard it, I really highly recommend people listen to it. It's kind of like Lincoln's Portrait by Copland, mm-hmm, but instead of Abraham Lincoln's words. It's Martin Luther King's words, and it's narration, and Schwantner's, you know, elegant bed of sound in which the speaker recites Martin Luther King's words. And it was so powerful to hear it. And everything he, in my opinion, everything he writes is like that. So he's a guitarist, and he knows what's possible. Others, they don't, and you have to help them.
What about Adler? Did you work directly with, I mean, obviously you have a whole album.
Yeah, well, Adler, you know, he started writing for the guitar before I met him. Mm-hmm. So Concerto is a triple commission. Adam Holtzman, Steve Robinson, and myself triple commissioned that thing. And it's hard. I mean, it really is hard. and we all played it. And it's a great piece, and I recorded it recently. It was written in the mid-90s, and I finally recorded it a couple of years ago. Sam, you know, he just wrote a new piece. I mean, he's going to be 95, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, shows up this new piece in my inbox. And Sam's written a flute and guitar piece for me and Bonnie. And I thought I was done, but no. So there's this new piece, and it's so hard and it's so busy, but it works because it's his language. He knows enough. He knows how to make it sound like Adler, like Britten knew how to make guitar sound like Britten. It didn't sound like a guitar. It sounds like Britten.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Adler's like that. And you had to make a couple of changes, and he reluctantly agreed, but he wasn't open to, he never is. He was, well, if you practice it, maybe it'll sound fine. So, you know, what are you going to say? No? Okay, I'll practice. And it does. It sounds okay. So we're getting ready to play this on a Sam Adler 95th birthday concert next week.
That's incredible. And I can 100% understand why those two composers that we've talked about, you know, because they do have, there's serial elements there, you know, which means that it's counterpoint, essentially. There's the notes have to, every note is in a place for a reason. And if you upset that, or you just start moving notes around, sometimes, not sometimes, but that can very well kind of cause some sort of foundational cracks in the work. I can imagine why he would be reluctant. You know, I've always kind of felt that with the new composers, or the Frank Martin or anything like that, that has sort of serial elements, not just atonality, but some sort of organizational element in it.
I would jump in just to say,
yeah,
it has to still swing. It has to swing.
Yeah.
Like when you hear Gould play Bach, like in the first Goldberg variations, that thing swings like crazy.
All the way through.
Right?
All the way through. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's highly contrapuntal music, but he makes it swing. And I think that for me, that's the door you want to walk through.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, that's funny you should say that, because there's actually this Tone Bass. You ever heard of these guys?
Yes.
Great. Sure. Great. You know, and there's a new sort of piano thing that just keeps on popping up on my YouTube of Seymour Bernstein just ripping Glenn Gould apart. And one of the things that he says is he doesn't like the way he sort of pounds on this, you know, on the last eighth note of a measure. And then, you know, he's like, you should be playing the first beat louder. And I'm like, no, because that's exactly what you're talking about. It's swinging. You're taking an off beat, and that's what I always did like about Gould's playing. I always used to say you could do the dishes to him. And I think that that's the thing. You could listen to it, and really it has the same effect that other kinds of music does. And I never thought about it, but it is true. It does swing.
It swings. And the idea of an offbeat, you know, I think that we're in good company right now, because when I know about great musicians like Ralph Kirkpatrick talk about offbeat, you know, emphasis.
Accentuation, yeah.
Yes. And he was a big proponent of that as a way to move the music forward. And I think that, I know what you mean about Gould. I know what you mean about the idea of doing the dishes. I heard that Gould practiced with the vacuum cleaner on.
I mean, nothing would surprise me.
No,
at this point.
But what a level of genius. And I know that some of my students one of them in particular right now is always coming in, and he's always, I can tell he's been listening to Gould because he's trying to play things probably faster than he should, yeah, or slower than he should. But he's doing it with commitment and with a commitment. And I'm not going to stop that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, I think when I was a student and I started listening to him, I would, my articulations would be very short. All of a sudden I was like cutting everything, and everything was like, and Adam or somebody was like, the notes have to be a little longer, Brett, like calm down.
And with the guitar, it's a second movement to stop, yeah, either by lifting or by replacing. Whereas with the piano, it's just up.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a kid who's playing, the Canarios, and I'm like, so I'm going to tell you something that's really going to upset you, but you have to take your thumb and you have to mute that G string right here. And it's going to suck. And he is so upset.
All you can do is give him good information.
Yeah.
He's going to figure out how to process it. And if not now, maybe when he gets, older.
That's the truth.
It's going to come back and scratch him in the back of the head.
And when you see a student play that you haven't seen in 10, 20 years,
yeah,
I mean, you must be able to see that they finally did listen to you, because they do. Everybody's listening all the time, right?
Yes. I think that's an incredible experience. And I think anyone who has that experience, I mean, I think that it validates an awful lot, because, the fingerprints are still all over them.
Mm-hmm.
But then they've had their experiences, right? Unique experience. As you can tell, it's both a combination of the information that we had many years ago, but their information that they've picked up over the years. The level of guitar playing has become so much more sophisticated. I don't mean to say that those before me or my generation weren't, but it's becoming so sophisticated. The level of guitar pedagogy is so sophisticated. New music for the guitar, so sophisticated. And guitars are so sophisticated. Guitar construction. I think everything 100 years ago was magnificent, or 200 years ago magnificent, we're standing on those shoulders, but we're really doing something right now. The guitar world is something that we can be proud of right now.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I mean, what do you think was the big thing? Do you think it was getting it into more colleges over the last 20 years?
Certainly that helped. Because there are places where people, all these hotbeds, I think you can say that about festivals too.
Yeah. Festivals are a big thing.
They're huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Every town has them now.
Yes. Yes. And any of the schools that you've mentioned, mm-hmm, both in Bruce's case, FSU, and Adam's case, UT, and certainly up here, and at Manhattan School, and USC, and San Francisco, and Yale, and I mean, unbelievable list of great places where there's a hotbed of young, the new breed of virtuosi. They're there, and they're going at it all the time with each other, and they're learning. And then they go off and they get jobs, and they bring that to their new environment. And there's just this... there's this thing that's happening, and it's really nice to be part of it. It's other instruments notice.
That's the most important thing, is catching up with those guys.
Yeah.
So that's the thing is as we move on, and as these players get better, eventually we're going to be right there with them, and that wasn't what I experienced in the 90s going to school, It wasn't that. We were just so far behind. It was almost laughable, to some of the other instruments.
I was just in Scotland at the Royal Conservatoire in Glasgow. I was playing Stephen Goss's new guitar concerto, and Goss was there. And we were talking a little bit, because he's really dialed in with the European scene. And we were kind of having a conversation about what's happening around, throughout not just the UK, but throughout Europe. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. Same thing's happening there. The guitar has become a blue plate special in all of these music schools. And, it's a great time. It's a great time to be a guitarist. There are more opportunities. There are more of us, though. So there's more competition, let's say. But I think it's a great time to be a guitarist. I think it's
Well, even we can even with things like, you know, I'm not talking the podcast, but the podcast, we didn't know who these people were before we were able to interview them this way. It was just very rare, you know, I mean, that people would actually get to know who you were, you know, unless they went to your concert and you said a couple of words, or unless they were judging you based on like an album cover,
right?
Which some of those album covers, we don't want to be judged.
That's,
you know, like, I've got pictures of mine where I look like a little pig.
Well, man, I'm in the same boat. But I agree with you that I think that this has, and it's become very good. Like even this Zoom link that we have right now,
it's stable.
When COVID first hit back 3 years ago, and I had to start doing some online teaching because we had to shut down, I hated it. It was awful. I couldn't hear anybody, nothing. Now look at this. This is great.
It is great. It is great. I never did these. I you know, talked ad nauseum about this on the show, but I never did these online before COVID. Ever. It was like 10 years of not doing it. And now it's just so easy and I can talk to so many more people. And do you do that? Do you do some teaching online? Do you have students that are exclusively online? You know,
I don't. I mean, I prefer, and I have such a big class up here that I do all my teaching with them. If I have to do it, I'll do it. But I'd much prefer to not do it. I'd much rather be in the same room. Maybe it's a luxury, but that is my preferred way of teaching. But I know that online teaching has become a big thing, and it's become a very productive thing.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of where, you know, because there are, like you said, there are a lot more guitarists now. And even for my generation, there was a limitation as far as getting college jobs. Definitely. I mean, 100%. So the fact that people can sort of just go, I like your playing. I want to study with you online is something that people, I think, will eventually look at more. I agree with you, though. I mean, you know, my relationship with my teachers is still strong. And a lot of that is because we were in the room together, you know.
Well, as far as I agree with that, and I'm that way with my teachers in my mind, both living and no longer living. Those are relationships that become part of us. They are among the most powerful relationships in our lives, and we're here because they were there. And in fact, a lot of our dreams come true in large part because of them, and now us. And we have to assume that role, and it's it makes life really special.
It does. And let's talk about your teachers. Let's talk about just a little, you know, about your sort of what your background was. How did you start? Were you a guitarist? Were you a pianist? I mean, you obviously, your playing is incredible, and especially the depth of your interpretations. You do some profound things with work, whether it's work from atonal or whether it's the Ponce or whatever it is, you know. I also want to talk about your role with Naxos.
Okay.
Because you were with Naxos for a while. Is that
yes, mean, I did the Bach record.
You were kind of one of the first big Naxos guys.
Yeah. Well, I'll say first, I'll answer your first question, then I'd love to. The first question, I grew up in Rhode Island, and I was born in 55, so there wasn't anything in the 50s. And like everybody, in junior high and high school, I had a rock band. Mm-hmm. I loved that. It was really wonderful. I taught myself to play electric guitar. Mm. And then one night, I was watching the Ed Sullivan Show with my dad. And my father was a Greek immigrant. And we were watching the show, Segovia's on. And I said, Dad, who is that? And again, I had no experience in classical music. There wasn't any in my house. But I saw this and heard this playing that was just so fluent and so uniquely beautiful. I now know he was playing the first etude of Villa-Lobos, and he was playing the Alemann from the E minor lute suite, first lute suite. Anyway, and he said, well, that's a real musician. Well, that was throwing down the gauntlet right there.
Yeah.
So there weren't really any guitar teachers. But Michael Lorimer was writing a column in Guitar Player magazine about classical guitar technique. I've told Michael this. That was my teacher. I did what Michael said, and I learned how to play to teach myself through reading Michael's column in Guitar Player magazine. Oh. After that, I went to the closest music school after I graduated from high school for 2 years. I went to Hart. And Alan Spriestesbach and Richard Provost were there, and I loved working with them. And then I met Manuel Barranco. So I moved to New York and transferred to Manhattan School and worked with Manuel for about 6 years through bachelor's, master's, and doctoral studies. And he was probably the most important person in my musical life, and still is. Manuel required precision and lyricism and everything that I admire, I hear in his playing. I worked also with Sharon Isbin when I was there, and a lot of the stuff she was doing with Rosalind Turek, a lot of the new cross string trills and all of those sorts of things, which were quite revolutionary at the time, she helped me with, and fingering things in a certain way that was unique and now become part of our fabric. And then Segovia came in 97. I had played for a few of his master classes, and I got to know Rose Augustine very well, and Assunta Caballera, who knew him. And I said, I'd like to bring him to Manhattan School. I was now chair of the guitar department there.
And he died in 87, so this was his last...
Yes.
This is the last year on Earth.
Yeah. Yes. This was... He died in that... He came to Manhattan in April, mm-hmm. and he died the following fall.
Jeez.
So it was just a few months later, and he was planning to come back. So anyway, so I told Rose, and she said, okay, well, she was incredible, but she was pretty crotchety. And she said, all right, well, if you really want to do that, we'll make it happen. So she finds the money. Manhattan decides to give him an honorary doctorate. Everyone I called said yes. I called Swiss Air, no problem, 3 first-class tickets. I called Westbury Hotel, no problem, suite for a week. I called Boutros Ghali, who is the Secretary General of the United Nations. Remember him?
Yes.
To give the commencement address. And I've got a whole bunch of pictures behind me over there on the wall from those occasions. And, you know, so Segovia, you know, he came and he taught my students, and that was something. All of our students, not just mine, but Manuel's students and Sharon's students and Barbosa Lima's students and my, it was unbelievable. And we had a wonderful, wonderful time. And then he said, you know, he asked me, what are you working on? And I said, well, I'm working on Follias d'Espagna. He said, oh, that's the world's greatest piece. Come to my hotel room, bring your guitar tomorrow at 3 o'clock.
And this is the first time that you've met him.
No, I had played for him in master classes before. First time I met him was in 82 at a master class at the Metropolitan Museum of Art mm-hmm. in 1982. And a bunch of us were playing there. Mark Del Priora played there, David Tannenbaum played there, Scott Tennant played there. A whole bunch of us were playing there. New Yorkers and also West Coast.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And I had played for him a couple of times subsequently. But this is the first time he ever offered for me to come and play. So I went and I started playing the Follias d'Espagna, and I followed every fingering, every slur, everything. Didn't want to get in trouble. And he told me some things that I've been wanting to tell people. I'm glad to be able to have the moment here. I'm glad somehow it came around to Ponce. He said, I started playing fewer slurs when I started playing in big halls. And I changed things from these original fingerings after nylon strings in the 40s. So when you see Segovia fingerings, like of the Fantasia for a Gentleman, for the guitar and orchestra, those are 1950s Segovia fingerings. He had nylon strings, which came around in the 40s. Rose also told me about how all that came about, but that's another conversation. DuPont came through with nylon. Segovia changed things. He was playing and fingering on gut. Gut is a whole different kind of animal, especially with nails on gut. It's nasty. So you slur more, and you find ways to hide intonation, and you didn't have to do that with nylon. Those early nylon strings were unbelievably good, frankly, better than current nylon strings. They're making something special. So, you know, we went through a whole bunch of Follias d'Espagna, and the other piece I played for him was Faya Omenaje. And it was great. I mean, he took that sound with him to the grave, that vision of beauty with him to the grave, and he was a force of nature, and his teaching was, you know, about as powerful as it comes. But it wasn't about the way we teach now. It wasn't about drawing out. It was about putting in. You go to play for Segovia, he knows that you want to know what he thinks, so he tells you what he thinks.
Right, and that's a different approach.
Yes.
Very different.
Very different, because, you know, I've always believed, and I think you do too from what I'm hearing, that a copy is never as good as an original. So we're trying to create originals. Every time someone comes to play, we're trying to bring out who they truly are. To draw out is the word education in Latin. It means to draw out.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so that's what true pedagogy is. But with these guys like Segovia and Casals and Rubinstein, they were men of their day, and they were all about do it like this. Everything is done as the performer, as the fountainhead.
So is that because no one was telling them what to do?
I don't know. Segovia was pretty self-taught.
Yeah,
he had a little bit of time with Yobet, but I think he mostly was self-taught. Geez, I don't know. I don't know.
I'm trying to figure it out because it was such a unique situation.
Yeah.
We another show I was on, not my show, we were talking about John Williams and Julian Bremen, how it just wouldn't happen again. We don't celebrate the artist as great man in the way that we did, even in the 50s.
Wow.
And so, you know, like the fact that that's one reason it won't happen. And but I don't know.
Well,
no, I know that there was something special, and I know that it wasn't just about Segovia being Segovia, because I, like you, remember hearing, I didn't see him on TV, but I remember hearing him for the first time in the back of a car when I was a teenager.
What? Oh, he,
wait. Me listening to a Segovia album.
And you were in a car.
I was in a car when I first heard it. Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't driving. I was, you know, kid. Somebody else was driving.
He wasn't in the back seat of your car.
No, he wouldn't. No, he wouldn't. He wouldn't get anywhere near my.
Do you remember what he was playing?
Yeah, he was playing Sevilla. You know.
Yeah.
Abanis. So he was playing, there was something about it that no one else can really do. There was sort of like there was a playfulness, an expressiveness, all at the same time. And it was really, I don't know, like there's something about his playing that maybe it's just the recording quality too has its charm, but I don't know. And that's so interesting about the strings that you're saying.
Rose told me an interesting story that they had, you know, Albert, he was living with her and Albert Augustine in there. They had a big brownstone on East 10th Street. A number of us have been there. We're there. Rose used to have dinners all the time. Mm-hmm. And we would get invited, you know, most of us were so broke that going and having a great dinner, she would often take us out to Tex-Mex or something, but we'd hang out at her house. And it was really something special. And one time she told me about how when DuPont first were making these strings, which we all thought were probably pretty primitive, you know, spools of fishing line, were not. And she said that they were strings that they would have these blind tests, and Segovia would have two Hausers. Get this, Albert Augustine's 1940 Hauser, which Bream eventually was able to play. That's the Augustine Hauser. And Segovia's 1937 Hauser in the same house at the same time. One of them had nylon strings, one of them had gut strings. Segovia played the same thing on both pieces. Everybody was there. Vladimir Bobry, from all those early Guitar Review, you know, characters, and that crowd.
Yeah.
And they had these blind tests. And Segovia would play the same thing on both great Hausers, both with low resonance pitch, because, you know, Hauser was making guitars. If you tap a guitar, there's a certain pitch, right? Mm. And so these guitars were down to E. Most guitars are at G. Sometimes they go down to F. My Damen's at F, which is really wonderful. But these guitars were down at E. That's why they just sound like that. And so he had these two rare Hausers, one nylon, one gut. And every single person voted for the nylon.
Yeah, well, that was, but just given his playing style too. I mean, that's a lot of, no offense to him, that's a lot of nail to hide.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. And there's nowhere to hide with gut. It's true. It's scratched and nasty. It's true.
I didn't know what gut, I don't even know what gut sounds like. I mean, maybe watching like a, you know, like a period, someone playing a, you know, like a, that's one of those 19th century guitars, like a Douglas James or concert or something. I maybe have heard a gut, but I don't think so. I don't think he uses them. So I don't know if I've ever really heard a gut.
It's a very rich sound, actually. Yeah. It's a beautiful sound. The problem was that they would break and that they were inconsistent. There's these new Nile gut strings and some of these hybrid things. The actual gut strings sound amazing. But they're highly impractical. So I understand that these early nylons were really something.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Well, I mean, yeah, it's amazing. What I really love about your generation is their proximity to Segovia. And it's just something that we just didn't grow up with. He was gone. So it's...
Wait, you know, let me get something. Hold on.
Sure. He's going back now. He has a beautiful, it's larger than I thought it was, the studio. You got a baby grand in there and everything.
Yeah, it's a
great studio.
I love it here. It's a good place. So I'll show you these, since we're talking about that era. Mm-hmm. So here's a picture. So look at this Motley Crue. I don't know if I can, let me turn the light off behind me. Maybe it'll be easier to see it.
Let me go ahead and describe to the listeners what I'm seeing. I'm seeing Segovia in the middle. Sharon has been on the left. Barbosa Lima further on the left, yourself and Manuel Barueco, the Manhattan School of Music faculty. This would be 1987, right?
That's right.
Is that everybody? Did I get everything right?
Perfect. I won't say anything more except that was everybody, and that was something. That was an amazing day. And also, we gave him an honorary degree that day.
Wow.
This was I think the day after that picture. So there's Segovia. And this man was the president of Manhattan, named Gideon Waldrop. But that's Gideon Waldrop. And he's since passed away, but he was, as it turns out, he did his PhD in composition at Eastman, and he was the dean of Juilliard for 25 years, and then he became the president of Manhattan. None of this would have happened if not for him. He was a great man.
It's so good that you're saying that, because we are having, I went to Manus for grad school, and we're having sort of the opposite situation occur, also, according to some people. But it is so important, whoever your dean is, right?
Oh, I'll say. I mean, these people, they create an environment that is a representation of who they are. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if Gideon Waldrop was a great man, and I loved working for him, and he saw the value in bringing Segovia and supporting this whole idea. It was very cool of him to do, and very special. The man that I worked here at Eastman when I first came, that was the dean, his name, Robert Freeman. He's recently died, and he was the head, you might recognize his name. He was the head of the School of Arts and Sciences at UT Austin after he finished here. He was truly a visionary. This was the finest administrator I ever had the pleasure of working with. A rare breed. They don't make them like this anymore. And not afraid, certainly willing to go out on a limb and do things that become special but are controversial at the time. And he really wanted to shake up the country club. And I liked working with him a lot. But anyway, Gideon Waldrop in that picture, he was a good man.
And he was excited about it. I mean, that's the thing, is that these are all contingent on people letting us in. And these are people that, you know, because you know that they had to fight. They had to sit there and they go, well, how much money is this guitar program going to bring, you know, or whatever.
Right.
What's the scholarship structure, which I'm sure is something I know it's a constant battle, right?
Oh,
every year.
Oh, and the price of education is obscene. It's not sustainable. We're headed to an era where something's got to give. It's too much money. And so, you know, we can't ask people to pay that kind of money unless we give them enough scholarship. It becomes a school for those who can afford to come rather than those who deserve to come. That's not right. That's not right. And I have that fight every year, and I'm not afraid to have it. But it's a problem.
Yeah, it is a problem. The issue of class, it just has no business being part of this. You know what I mean? And the fact that we just have to deal with this, this is unique to our, you know, hemisphere. It's yeah. just so ridiculous. It drives me crazy.
No, and it's, again, I told you I was just in Scotland. And we know that European education has a reputation for being free, underwritten. But I actually went to school at Manhattan with the man who's the president of the Royal Conservatoire right now. We just happened to come across each other.
Yeah.
We had a wonderful time. And he told me that, no, now half the population at the Royal Conservatoire are Americans. And they pay full freight. It's still less than what they would pay in an American school, but it's like $20,000 a year, which is okay compared to like $70,000 a year. Still a lot less, but they're paying, and the local people get to pay a lot less, kind of like in-state out-of-state tuition, but on a national level. Their era of free education, no more. They're starting to have to do it too.
Yeah, well, that's just sort of the direction that the UK is kind of going in general, it seems like. They're just kind of going for more of that.
Yeah.
That vibe. It's too bad.
The whole Brexit thing, man. I mean, yeah. Wow. What a time they're going through.
It is amazing, and I love that country so much. So it's really too bad to struggle through that when they were so ahead of the game for so long.
Yeah.
But we're kind of coming sort of to the end now. So I did want to touch a little bit on Naxos, just because, I haven't had Norbert on or anybody else. And I want to talk to somebody who was sort of part of that movement when it was such an important thing for people my age who had to buy albums when they were students. And you had to choose which Beethoven recording you were going with, whether you're going with John Elliott Gardner and the period instruments, or you're going to go with Von Karajan and something more straightforward. And the same went, to everything. I guess Paul Odet was sort of the guy. Nigel North was sort of the guy for the lute. You were one of those people that we would listen to, and you were affordable. These CDs were $6 retail in a Tower Records new at a time when everything else was going from $15.99 by the time CDs sort of conked out in the early aughts. Yep. CDs, people should remember, were $19. They were $18.99. Yep. But Naxos kept it below $10 the entire lifespan. And it was such an important thing. What was sort of your role in that movement, and how did you kind of how did you make money with it? How did it work?
I'm happy to talk about this, and I know that a lot of the guys who were tapped by Norbert to do this, and Adam is one of them, Jason Veal is one of them, John Holmquist was one of them. I mean, there's a lot of us that were tapped. Mark Teicholz.
Yeah, Mark Teicholz, yeah.
Right, so Norbert was the guy, and he made friends with a guy named Klaus Heyman. He was the head of it. Mm-hmm. And he married a violinist, and he wanted to be able to record his wife. So he starts this little recording company called it Naxos. I mean, it was a real kind of a homespun thing at first. Eventually it started to grow, and they decided they were gonna branch out. He meets up with Norbert, who was really the Segovia of Canada. I mean, Norbert was playing with every orchestra. He was playing all over the place, and a great guitarist.
Yeah.
And he, great guitarist. And so they made a real connection together. And he had said to Norbert, look, we're creating this new label. It's going to be essentially a repertoire label. We want to record as much as possible. We want to rack by composer.
Yeah.
Interested in how music is sold. We want music libraries to buy. Anyway, they had a kind of a model of how they were going to do this, which is a little different than how things had been going up until then. Mm-hmm. Norbert, being the nicest guy in the world, asked all of his friends who he knew from festivals and interacting and everything else if we wanted to do something. And he shared the water bowl. Thanks to Norbert, I got to record Bach. And he had heard me play. I was working on the three sonatas. Back in the day, there weren't much of, there, people weren't really playing those back in the
day. They weren't playing violin sonatas, no.
And so he heard me play them, and he said, well, are you interested in recording these? And I said, Sure. I mean, I hope I can do them justice, but I would love to. Yeah. He also started a Soar project. They wanted to record the complete works of Soar. So a number of us each did a record or two. They did that with Merritz, and they did that with, you know, with other composers. And now they're doing things by territory, by countries. But in those early days, it was like that. And each paid 3,000 Deutschmarks. This was before the euro. We were each paid 3,000 Deutschmarks to make this record. Norbert uses this church, I think still to this day, up in Newmarket, which is north of Canada, in a little Catholic church that sounds like that. And that's right. All these Naxos records have all been made in that church that he's recorded with his wife, Bonnie Silver. She's kind of the editor. And he does all the technology, and they're both together in this little room off to the side with videos, and we're all up in the altar of this church, out in the middle of nowhere, and making these records. And I did two of them, the Bach one and a Soar one. I did the last works of Soar, which included Elie Jacques, and then the Opus 60 studies and Opus 58, which I really love that. They were his last three pieces. And all the records that he made, I thought, really had his fingerprint. They all sound great. They all work really well. Even in those early days of digital technology, they had an unbelievably warm, organic sound.
Hmm. Yeah. They did.
Yeah.
They did. It was almost like impossible to believe that could be done at that price point.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the few labels that actually survived or survives.
From that era. Like Telarc is gone.
Yeah.
A lot of them are gone. It's pretty fantastic what he's done. I really have to have him on.
You should.
But I have enjoyed this immensely. It's great to finally meet you after, you know, listening to you for 30 years.
That's fantastic. It's my pleasure. You're doing a great thing for everybody in the guitar world. When somebody does something good, it's good for all of us. Yeah. And you're doing something great, and I'm deeply grateful to be part of it. And you know, all my very deep respect for what you're doing too, Brett. Thank you.
All right, everybody, that's it for my time with Nicholas Galusis. Make sure you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support and support the show. That's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support, or write me at brett@brettwilliamsmusic.com to get yourself a little advertising spot on here and talk about whatever project you're doing. It's cheap and it makes me happy. Anything I can do. Have a good time. I'll see you next time.